This is the talk for the Kappa Kappa Gamma event in Denver. In the night, in mid-dream, people who are entire strangers to one another sometimes will congregate atop my pillow. They file into my sleeping skull in perplexing medleys. A face from grade school may be twinned with one met a week ago on a rainforest trail in the Olympic Mountains. A pair of friends I joked with yesterday now drift in arguing with an editor I work for more than 1,000 miles from here. How thin the brain walls must be. So easily can acquaintanceships be struck up among these random residents of the dark. Memory, the near neighborhood of dream, is almost as casual in its hospitality. When I fix my sandwich lunch in a quiet noon, I may find myself sitting down 30 years ago in the company of the erect old cowboy from Texas, Walter Badgett. Forever the same is the meal with Walter. Fried mush with dark corn syrup, and bread which Walter first has toasted and then dried in the oven. When we bite, it shatters and crashes in our mouths, and the more we eat, the fuller our plates grow with the shrapnel of crumbs. After the last roaring bite, Walter sits back, tall as 2 of the 10-year-old me, and asks down, "Well, reckon we can make it through till night now?" I step to the stove for tea, and come instead onto the battered blue enamel coffee pot in a sheepherder's wagon. My father's voice saying, "You could float your grandma's flat iron on the Swede's coffee." I walk back toward my typewriter, past a window framing the backyard fir trees. They are replaced by the wind-leaning jack pines of one Montana ridgeline or another. I glance higher for some hint of the weather, and the square of air broadens and broadens to become the blue expanse over Montana rangeland, so vast and vaulting that it rears from the foundation line of the plains horizon to form the walls and roof of all of life's experience that my younger self could imagine. A single great house of sky. Those words, the title section of my first book, This House of Sky, I suppose began my career of being freighted in for occasions like this to spout words about words. I take it that the only conceivable reason for asking a writer to talk out loud is to try to find out what he's up to. Insofar as I know what I'm up to, I'll concentrate for the rest of my 20-minute slot here on some of the ingredients of my work, how a writer, or at least this writer, makes books. The makings of a book, and so far I've made 5 more since This House of Sky, and have a couple of others wanting to happen. The makings of a book, I'm sorry to say, have more salt of perspiration than inspiration. For me, the sweat work begins with thinking up the situation for a book. The job description is maybe a little odd. Staring holes into the trees outside your window while you think, what if? What if 2 people had been in love, had a war of the heart and snapped apart, but still had to work in the same office? What if it was a really small office, the size of a motorhome. 3 years of what-ifing, and here is this book. What if I called it Ride With Me, Mariah Montana? Featuring a newspaper photographer named Mariah, her emphatically ex-husband, Riley Wright, the reporter assigned with her to do a series of stories for Montana's centennial. The two of them being driven around the state of Montana by Mariah's newly widowed father, Jick McCaskill, in his Winnebago. As the characters themselves find, if you don't watch out, life turns out to be what's happened to you while you were busy making other plans. So the writer, or at least this writer, has to make the words and sentences add up day by day, the arithmetic of creation. Along with the daily woodpile of words, though, the carvings of craft have to add up too. In the course of my first novel, The Sea Runners, I got in touch with a park ranger up at Sitka, who was an expert on the carpentry and shipbuilding that went on there when Alaska still was Russian America. He gave me not only the working details I needed for some scenes in The Sea Runners, but he also wrote out for me a quote from the English poet William Blake. Art cannot exist but in minutely organized particulars. When I'd finished blinking over the literary and philosophical bent of park rangers these days, probably something he had needed to get through the era of James Watt, it occurred to me that the quote explains much of the craft that I believe has to go into the writing of a book. An example: at one turn of the plot in Ride With Me, Mariah Montana, the three main characters visit the family ranch that the reporter, Riley Wright, turned his back on for a newspaper life instead. Riley's rancher brother, Morgan Wright, shows up briefly to confront Riley, and here is Morgan's appearance. Morgan stood spraddled, thumbs alone showing from the weather-worn hands parked in his front pockets, as though it might take all the time in the universe to hear this matter out. The vital word, what is sometimes called the crystallizing detail, in that sentence is the verb parked. Those hands parked in the front pockets of Morgan's blue jeans, habitually, naturally, not stuck in his pockets, jammed in his pockets, but just, by God, parked. And I only worked for about half a day to come up with that one precise word, that minute particular. The details that make a book sound believable, the right stuff, the W-R-I-T-E stuff, do not just stroll up to a writer and volunteer themselves. They have to be located, coaxed, tracked down, spied at, eavesdropped on, whatever it takes. In the middle book of this trilogy I've just done, for instance, English Creek, I needed to know the details of a haying season in Montana in the 1930s, when the haying machinery still was run mostly by horses instead of horsepower, so that my narrator would have that experience, the memory in him of the leather reins in my hands like great kite lines to the pair of rhythmically tugging horse outlines in front of me. When I was a kid, just after World War II, my dad was a haying contractor every summer, and his crews largely put up hay in that old workhorse way. So I did have my own memories to bring in and use, but I had to admit to myself, those days when I was a red-headed kid in a Montana hayfield are getting to be a long time ago in a galaxy far away. So to add other memories to my own, I ran little classified ads in weekly newspapers in Montana, asking to hear from anybody who had worked on a haying crew there in the late 1930s. I heard from about a dozen people, and in corresponding with them or talking to them, I captured the details I needed. But it doesn't stop even there. The writer's quest, job of enlisting the right details onto the waiting white space of paper. Because sometimes those details have to be heard with the eye and seen with the ear. Among the people I heard from, in echo from those little ads I'd run, was a woman who took in laundry from hay crews. I wanted details, did I? The laundry lady had them in her letter to me. The only problem was, in an already crowded book, there was no room to bring in a character just to do the laundry. But those passionately precise details she had written to me kept on humming to my eye every time I reread the rhythms of her sentences. They kept showing themselves in my ear as a unique and valid performance. And so, not in English Creek, and not even in the next book I wrote, Dancing at the Rascal Fair, but in this book, those details of hers finally danced onto the page. Not in Haying Country at all, but in this quite different vignette written by the reporter in Ride With Me, Mariah Montana, himself a fictional character. Age is humped on her small back. It began to descend there in 1936 in daily hours over a washboard, scrubbing at the Missouri-mudded clothing of the men at labor on the biggest earthen dam in the world, Fort Peck. We went there with just nothing. My husband, J.L., got on as a roustabout. I wanted to find some way of earning, too, so I put up a sign, "Laundry Done Here." I charged 15 cents for shirts, and that was washed, ironed, mended, and loose buttons sewn on, and 10 cents for a pair of shorts, another 10 cents for an undervest, 5 cents for a handkerchief, and 10 cents for a pair of socks. Any kind of pants was 25 cents for washing and pressing. I had the business. Don't think I didn't. Those 3 years at Fort Peck, I always had 6 lines of clothes hanging in the yard. I don't know. Maybe that soliloquy on hand laundry registered on me so powerfully, because writing seems kind of like that. Hanging out sentence after sentence, hoping each one will dance on the wind, yet stay pinned to some visible means of support. And as with any chore, it's useful to be reminded that we're not the first ones who've ever had to do it, and who've managed to do it, maybe even have shown us how to do it, with a little distinction. Any of us who have ever looked at our family photo albums know that, genetically speaking, we are not so much ourselves but piecework of those before us. And writers, too, have lineage, heritage. The writing that makes books out of lore and lingo is a craft that has to be learned and worked at. One of the ancestors I chose upon becoming a working writer was waiting for me there in the pages of his sea stories, Joseph Conrad. Joseph Conrad, of course, is famous for the sweep of his rhetoric, the oceanic power of his sentences. Every literary critic knows that. But it seems to me what they either don't know or haven't said is something else that Conrad was just as terrific at. Quick characterization. For instance, in Conrad's great storm at sea story, Typhoon, the central figure is the most literal-minded, phlegmatic character in literary history, Captain McQuirr, who simply outlasts the typhoon by having about as much imagination as a box of rocks. But there's also the one sentence summary of the captain's wife. The only secret of her life was her abject terror of the time when her husband would come home to stay for good. So, the heritage of craftsmanship I see in Conrad is to make the minor characters of a book vivid too. To make them behave as importantly in my pages as Laurence Olivier said each actor in a play must contribute to the play as a whole. The third spear carrier on the left should believe that the play is all about the third spear carrier on the left. Here then is one of my spear carriers. He doesn't even have a name. And ride with me, Mariah Montana. She's simply the lead singer in a country and western band called the Roadkill Angels. But here she comes. The woman singer didn't look like much. Chunky, in an old gray gabardine cattle dealer suit, her blonde hair cut in an approximate fringe. But her voice made maximum appearance, so to speak. She sang, my God, she sang with a power and a timber that pulled at us just short of touch, as when static electricity makes the hair on an arm stand straight when a hand moves just above it. Holding the microphone like she was sipping from it, she sent that voice surging and tremoring, letting it ride and fall with the cascades of the instruments, but always atop, always reaching the words out and out to the crowd of us. So, those are at least a handful of the makings of books such as mine, and doubtless of many other writers as well. The what-ifs, which, after enough staring, come down out of the forest of the mind with the liquid hops of a squirrel. The minute particulars that are the molecules of literary creation. The lineage of craftsmanship that a writer tries to live up to as he chores away at the lifting of words onto paper. All in all, it's a job description which it has taken the Internal Revenue Service in its omniscience to do justice to. In the IRS four-digit codes for self-employed business or professional people, the writer looks in vain down the pageful of numerals for beauticians and undertakers and even used car salesmen, to find that his occupation is left to that last lonely line down in the corner, unable to classify. Maybe, though, we must hope that writing is always beyond the grasp of governments. Our best guarantee of that, I suppose, is to keep our work on the frontiers of imagination. That, indeed, might even be in the novelist's job description. Fiction is a deliberate dream. Probably any writing done with passion is. At least, so it seems, in the daily surprise when you are a writer, and you sit down to a keyboard to see what the fingers have to say to you. And they begin in the night, in mid-dream.
Recently there were reports Moscow had decided to restore his citizenship. Solzhenitsyn's views are alien to me, Gorbachev said. He is living in the past. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Bolivian leaders say they've passed a law that returns control of vast areas of tropical rainforest to the Indians who live there. The law would also limit exploitation by logging companies. Bolivian President Jaime Paz Zamora met with Indian leaders to announce the legislation yesterday. Some 800 Indians drew attention to the destruction of the rainforest with a 35-day march across the Andes Mountains to La Paz, Bolivia's capital. Under the new law, the Indians will resume control of almost 2 million acres of land. This is NPR News from Washington.
I'm Robert Siegel. Later today on All Things Considered, the war on drugs has invaded the nation's public housing project. Authorities are trying to get dealers out of public housing, but some say innocent... It's reconsidered. Also, the news later today on NPR's All Things Considered.
You'll hear All Things Considered at 4:30 on nearly 95 FM KUOW Seattle. Or right now, you'll hear Ann Silberman tell us about traffic.
We have a lot of slow traffic on southbound 5 in the Everett area from the Eastmont Interchange nearly down to 128. That's where there is a disabled bus blocking one of the lanes. Southbound I-5 near Mercer in downtown Seattle, a disabled car blocks the left lane there. And in Tacoma, southbound 5 near Bridgeport, watch out for a box in the roadway. I'm Ann Silberman for KUOW.
On KUOW. Ivan Doig's newest novel and the final part of his Montana trilogy is Ride With Me, Mariah Montana. Jick is a crusty widower rancher. His daughter Mariah is a vivacious photographer for a Montana newspaper where her ex-husband Riley writes a column. In 1989, Montana's centennial year, Mariah and Riley get themselves an assignment to wander the state filing stories for their paper. Mariah talks Jick into driving them in his Winnebago. Ivan Doig is a former ranch hand and newspaper man. He holds a doctorate in history from the University of Washington. Thanks very much for being on Seattle Afternoon today.
Nice to be back here.
You have traveled the roads of Montana yourself with your wife. That has echoes of some of the incidents in this book.
That's right, Ross. We did rent a motorhome for a while, head out into eastern Montana for the sake of this book. As it turned out, headed out into 105-degree weather during the summer drought in 1988. So we got at least as much traveling as we bargained for. I made a train trip out earlier. I managed to lock myself out of a rental car at the Chief Joseph Battlefield one cold, windy evening and immediately foisted that off onto Riley for the book. So, yeah.
You do quite a bit of factual research to write fiction. Why do you do that?
Mm-hmm. Facts seem to trigger my imagination. I always try to go out and take a look at what I'm going to write about, whether it's the landscape or the old towns from which I created the fictional town of Grove On in this trilogy. And it just seems to flint off. Imagination flints off fact for me, and I then imagine the fiction. Fiction is, a kind of a deliberate dream, and so I'm out there looking for ingredients of the dream.
Well, you've also done quite a bit of research into the way people in Montana spoke, particularly from your early historical novels. What are some good Montanisms?
Well, how you doing is, of course, one of the basic ones of my dad's generation. The voice I'm trying to write in these two books in which Jick McCaskill has narrated first English Creek, or English Crick, mm-hmm. as Jick would say, and now Ride With Me, Mariah Montana. And so I, quite frankly, eavesdrop. There were marvelous places in Montana to eavesdrop, bars and cafes, guys gathering at the tables early in the morning. Folklorists, I believe, call it the big table mm-hmm. in a cafe where guys in tractor caps will come in and have their first coffee. I always call it the geezer table and figure out what they're griping about, how they're joshing one another and so forth. And so, and throughout the book, too, I've tried to have a kind of family of language following through. So there are a variety of how people toast each other as they have drinks. Begins, I believe, in Dancing at the Rascal Fair, where Lucas Barclay says, broth to the ill and stilts to the lame when he takes a drink. And in English Creek, it is Jick saying something like, here's how, there's lead in your pencil. And they're in Mariah Montana, Jick is saying, nurse, how about another round of jelly sandwiches here, as he orders a round of scotch.
As Jick travels the state, he sometimes expresses a surprise at some of the things he sees.
Mm-hmm.
Do Montanans know their state?
They know each other, and they know of their state. Montana is a roughly a small city expanded over an area about the size of Spain. And so you find that Montanans will know of each other. They will know somebody's cousin or somebody they went to high school with at opposite ends of the state, which may be 600 miles apart, Ekalakat to Moise or something like that. But the landscapes can be quite different. And so if you do get to a place like Ekalakat, it is quite Dakotan, as I would say, or Midwestern. Mm-hmm. And at the other ends of the state, a place like Kalispell, is much more Northwestern.
Ivan Doig is my guest on Seattle Afternoon. Could you read a section from the new book for me?
Yes, I'll be glad to. Here's a brief section from a portion of the book where Jick, Mariah, and Riley are watching a grizzly bear be moved, and it triggers in Jick the memory of the time he himself faced down and had to shoot a grizzly 25 years before. This is Jick. "I will swear on all the Bibles there are, I was not intentionally delaying the bear's execution. Rather, I was settling the barrel of the .30-06 across a silvered stump for a businesslike heart shot, when instead the grizzly abruptly began climbing the tree, attacking up the tree, erupting up the tree, whatever way it can be strongest said. Branches as thick as my arms are cracking off and flying, widowmakers torn loose by the storm of fur. The fantastic claws raking furrows into the wood, massively exerting bulk of body, launching and launching itself into that tree. The trap dangling from the bear's rear toes was coursing upward too, tautening the chain fastened into the bullpine log. The log lifted at its chained end, began to be dragged to the tree, the bear bellowing its pain and rage at the strain of that taut pull, yet still mauling its way up the tree. I stood stunned at the excruciating tug of war, the arithmetic of hell that was happening. For the log's dead weight on those toes could... Then I at last realized the grizzly was trying to tear its toes off to get free."
Hmm. You ever seen a grizzly?
At the Seattle Zoo, I spent a good portion of my afternoons one season down watching the grizzly in the Seattle Zoo. And in the research in Montana, I was in contact both with the guy who is in charge of what I call bear moving and what he calls the relocation process. And I had fortunately interviewed an old rancher years before who had indeed trapped and killed many grizzlies alongside his sheep ranch.
How long has writing the entire trilogy taken you?
This has been pretty much my work of the 1980s. There are 8 years of research and time at the keyboard into this, Ross, and a couple of years of thinking and research before that, so roughly 10.
Did you know when you started the first part, generally, where you would be going in the second and third parts?
I knew the chronology, that the books would have 1889, Montana's time of statehood, showing up in Dancing at the Rascal Fair. English Creek would be 50 years later, and Ride With Me, Mariah, Montana, in the centennial year, last year, Montana's centennial year, as it was here in Washington. So.
Did you ever run into any problems of in the earlier works setting things up so that the later works had to follow them and then going, gosh, I wish I hadn't done that?
Well, part of the challenge and that keeps me interested in writing these books is solving the holes I get myself into. And so I did leave an incident in English Creek which had to be resolved in the other books, and it proved to be the climactic love moment between Angus and Anna in Dancing at the Rascal Fair when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to leave these holes into hyperspace or whatever and have to explore into them.
In your study of Western history, what have you found that generally has been left out in the public image of what happened in the West?
Well, the cowboy myth doesn't begin to cover the American West. It's the prime thing which I think all of us who try to write about the West have to come up against, that the cowboy myth persists. You still see Marlboro Man cutouts along the highways in Montana. But the West is immensely more complicated than that. The background of the Spanish, the Indians, the coastal explorers out here, the homesteaders, which I tried to write about in Dancing at the Rascal Fair, it is not simply one current of cowboys sweeping everything before them. It's more like a very complicated set of whirlpools.
Well, you're also interested in what people do when they work. So much of the time that is completely left out of any type of fiction. Why are you interested in what people do when they work?
There's always a kind of a way of life immediately attached to people's jobs. With it comes a vocabulary, and I'm interested in the language of how people talk about what they do. That's often maybe the richest portions of their lives. In places like Montana, certainly out of my own family background, we didn't have much else except our what we hoped was at least silver, if not golden, tongues to tell stories with, to have sayings and so on. And the rhythms, the craft, I think I try to approach writing as a craft, and so the craft of how people do their jobs.
Your writing, your earlier writing, your newspaper writing, mm-hmm. and magazine writing, you've talked about as a craft, and mm-hmm. as you move into writing novels, moving more toward art, did the early writing help your later writing, or was it something you had to unlearn in order to write novels?
Well, certainly the discipline of deadlines and making yourself sit down and work as I have a small card above my typewriter to say this to me every day, anybody can write on a good day. And so to learn the craft, be a professional, to turn out the given number of words a day when maybe you're grumpy or sick or whatever, that was very valuable, yes.
What do you do on a bad day when the page is blank? What do you do to get yourself going?
I try to write a page dialogue, perhaps, try to get the people talking on the paper. Perhaps I will see what the weather might be that day. I'll go through my accumulation of file cards and try to apply some landscape to the situation.
Mm-hmm. Have you left Montana behind in your writing with the conclusion of this trilogy, or do you think you will continue to cite your work there?
Well, Montana, I guess, will never be out of me.
You've been here for 21 years.
I've been here for 21 years. I've been taken to reading back of James Joyce's experience. People used to ask him why he kept writing about Dublin when he was in Paris. And he said, well, have I ever left? And indeed, that's my situation. Have I ever left Montana, or has it ever left me? So the next book will have some more Montana in it, although also probably some American Southwest. It's going to be a look at the life of a young woman born in Montana in 1913 and died out there very early in 1945, and she happens to have been my mother.
I don't know if this is true. Definitely want to check it out, but there was a figure tossed about that. According to one survey, 60% of Americans have never read a book. And whether or not that's true, we do know that the rates of literacy are just plunging in this country. Mm-hmm. As a novelist, does that concern you at all?
Well, it certainly does. Reading maybe always has been a sort of an elite activity, but I've been somewhat heartened by the generational spread of people I see in bookstores, not just for my books, but for others. And quite frankly, I think the baby boom generation is going to read a lot of books between now and the end of its time. They're highly educated, and so I think there is a considerable hope for an increase in certain kinds of reading.
You've talked about how, while you were researching your books in Montana in the 80s, many of the hardships from a previous mm-hmm. historical time were reflected in what was going on in the present. What kind of things?
The great cycles of weather that seemed to wheel back through Montana, through other portions of the American West as well. The drought, for instance, and looking back the 100 years covered by this trilogy, there was a drought in the 1930s, there was the terrible drought at the end of 1919. Big winters come into Montana on roughly a 30-year basis. Every 30 years you can count on something like the Alaskan Express of a couple of winters ago. And along with these weather cycles come economic cycles of people either hunkering down to stay or getting out.
Dick Estelle with the Radio Reader is going to be reading from Ride With Me, Mariah Montana. How do you like his reading of your work?
Just fine. He has listeners out there hither and yon, and so every time Dick reads, I begin getting letters from, well, now that he's on, I guess, WNYC in New York, people in Brooklyn saying, I never heard of you, but Dick Estelle read you.
Ivan Doig, thanks very much for being on Seattle Afternoon today.
Thank you, Ralph.
The completion of the Montana Trilogy, Ride With Me, Mariah Montana, is in bookstores now. This is Seattle Afternoon.
Thank heavens for those of you in bookstores, or I'd probably be spending my fall at rest areas along I-5 and I-90 trying to sell Ride With Me, Mariah Montana out of the back of a Winnebago. As it is, you give the book and me a roof over our heads and a floor under our sales figures. This becomes the season when we writers write in what we've already written and do book signings for your customers, our readers. Predictably quirky things happen. Somewhere along the line in the dozens of book signings, a shirt-tail relative or somebody we went to grade school with, or a local writer who has adopted the bookstore as a refuge from white space, one of those will show up and do their utmost to shield us from the paying customers. Or perfectly respectable-looking people will look us in the eye and ask for extraplanetary inscriptions. In the Montana book tour I just did, a former cafe owner wanted his sign to what he said was his honorary Indian name, which was Many Eggs. And a woman caused me to wonder if I've made a breakthrough to readership among poodles. She wanted hers signed to Taffy Ittles. The longer I'm around it, the more the book business seems a wonder in all its parts. In my time slot here tonight, I want to give back to you, as booksellers, as the people into whose daily lives come our books and our obstreperous readers, a story you rewarded me with at one of those memorable events called book signings. She's familiar, I thought to myself as soon as I saw her, standing in the line of book buyers waiting to tell my pen their names. She was 50-ish and stylish in a tailored gray suit and wearing a matching gray felt hat. Really wearing that hat, the brim riding down to the right in that perfect manner Ingrid Bergman wore hers to the airfield and destiny at the finale of Casablanca. The occasion was the Oregon Historical Society's annual Christmas book festivity, with 77 authors on hand all Sunday afternoon to sign our wares. The kind of event that some writers, although never Tess nor Jim nor Barry nor I, refer to as a cattle call signing. The Oregon Historical Society was doing things up wonderfully, with a wassail bowl, the Gentle Winds consort wafting Christmas carols, and the book public, Portland chapter, thronging through, swapping us their questions and comments for our inscriptions. "I certainly did like that Big Sky book of yours," somebody was saying. Well, actually, A.B. Guthrie Jr. wrote The Big Sky. I was trying to fend and sign books and simultaneously sneak glances at the woman there in line, trying to read that face. It was square-cut but handsome, and I managed to single out the main familiarity in it, the prominent broad cheekbones that built a rugged proportion, corners of endurance, into the look of her. But who did she look like? "That character, Jick, in this book," somebody was saying. "Is he really you?" "Well, not really. It's fiction," I kept signing, kept wondering about her. This was a reversed role, for me to be pursuing someone else's resemblance instead of one seeking me out. Then, as now, I had just been to Montana, and there in the country where I grew up, at bookstore after bookstore, Relatives and old-timers had informed me how much I now resemble my great-uncle, D.L. Doig. I see so myself whenever I spread the family photos. Strange how it can be portions of persons from other times. D.L.'s long life ended the summer I was born, 1939. And I'd much rather be mirrored in the snapshot poses of my good-looking father, with his Stockman Stetson cocked down just so for rodeo day. But no, Shaggy, avuncular old D.L. is my pattern. My beard imitates his, and I'd equal his tubbiness if I ate half of what I wanted to. And D.L. and I maybe have the same askance gaze at life, which perhaps explains why I've ended up as a writer, and D.L. ended up pretty far along toward his goal of catching every trout in the Missouri River. "I know I've seen you before," I said as soon as the woman of the hat reached me in the book line. "Where did we meet?" She shook her head twice. I was still intent on her face, those unmistakable cheekbones, but her attention was fixed on the books beside me. "This book." She reached past my shiny new novel of the time, English Creek, and put her hand on the display copy of This House of Sky, my memoir of Montana and my family. "Your father in here," she said. "He was so much like mine. I can't begin to tell you. The way his life never..." I nodded and waited. "I hear this from time to time. That first book of mine was largely the story of my father's struggle against hard luck. Sickness, horseback mishaps, the depression, Montana weather, the early death of my mother. Why was his life so closely stalked this way?" I had written in the pages beneath this woman's hand. "And how was it that he lasted as he did? The cost that this father of mine paid and all the surviving he had to do, I know enough about. But about why life had to dangle him such terms, not nearly enough." My father's was not a singular story in the high, dry West. And at his funeral 20 years ago, I could look around the chapel and see several similar lives not yet quite ended. Now I was in her scrutiny. "I never heard of you until I saw this book in a store. I bought it because my maiden name was Doig." Aha, I should have known. Familiar was due to its natural antecedent, family. D.L. fathered 9 Doigs, my grandfather another 6, and by now we are a populace of our own in Montana and elsewhere in the Northwest. I simply needed to find where this woman fitted into the cousinage. "Uh-uh. I was born in Massachusetts," she told me, "and spent almost all of my life there until now." "What, no Montana relatives at all?" "No, none." Her hand and attention were on This House of Sky again. "Our fathers, their lives were so..." "I wish I could make you know how much of my father I saw in yours," she insisted. "Yeah, well, that's interesting, but..." I still was stymied by our continental gap of kinship. Then I happened to think of the one other place in the world besides Montana where the Doig name crops up. "Do you know where your family originally came from? Was it Scotland?" "Yes. A town called Brechin." I almost fell over in astonishment. Months before, I'd gone to Scotland to begin the trilogy's novel about the Scottish emigrants who homesteaded in Montana late in the last century, dancing at the Rascal Fair. Wanting to base the story somewhere in the linen-weaving area around Dundee, where my own family originated, D.L. Doig and my grandfather both were tailors there before they came over to become Montana ranchers. I went from town to town through that part of Scotland trying to find a place for the MacCaskill family line. Angus of Dancing at the Rascal Fair, and through him, Mac and Jick in English Creek, and now Mariah to spring from. The actual home site of the Doigs, Panbride, was too tiny. Kerry Moore seemed too dour. Forfar seemed too big. Arbroath to this, Munross to that. No candidate town seemed right, until Carol and I drove into one I had never heard of, Brechin. Brechin captivated me at once, with its steep high street wending down to its river, its Celtic round tower beside its medieval cathedral, its general appearance of having been chiseled complete from Scotland's stone earth rather than built. Since that day, and my immediate decision to imagine the life of the MacCaskills from Brechin, I knew from old census registers who lived along the river street near the huge linen mill in the 1880s, knew their ages and birthplaces and occupations, knew from Carol's photos of the town how clock faces preside over it from the cathedral tower, the municipal building, and every church. From Brechin, I tried to convey my astonishment to the woman of the hat, point out to her that somewhere there in the Scottish past we were surely related, tell her about my Brechin-born book-to-be. She smiled politely enough, but this house of sky, in which my father somehow twinned hers, was the only book of mine that intrigued her. Our conversation kept crisscrossing until we recognized that we both were baffled about where our coincidences led. The book buyers in line behind her deserved their turn. I had a plane to catch as soon as the afternoon of bookmanship was over. A last time, I tried to evoke Brechin for her, and again from her, "I wish I could make you know how much of my father I saw in yours." The wind consort blew a Merry Christmas gust our way. She and I took a final look at each other, the store away, shook hands, and she went. Through the rest of the afternoon, I thought of what it had taken to cause our two lives to cross. Our same rare name, our other coincidences. Montana and Massachusetts do not count. Time is the true community. A weaver's town, it must be, like Brechin, where people with faces like ours work our genetic threads on the loom called history. D.L. Doig, a century ago, decides to refashion the family pattern, leaves Scotland for the American West, and now I write of that fabric of emigration and homesteading, and trying to make a life on the land. The Doig grandfather of the Lady of the Hat rejects Brechin, chooses the texture of Boston, and she one day sees in a bookstore a book with my name on it. Small wonder that as the album photos try to tell us, we are not so much ourselves, but piecework of those before us. The last of this story that I owe to you booksellers, who provide the magical shuffle of the cards that bring writer's words and reader's eyes together, the last of it happened that night in the homeward plane when the jolt of recognition found me. I realized what I'd been trying to read from the woman's features since the moment she appeared in the book buyer's line. Who else had worn a hat at that precise, perfect angle? Who else had those ancestral promontory cheekbones? My father. This will be the Fort Worth 10-minute talk on book dedications. Since you have four other chances to hear something nifty tonight, I figured I might as well be the guy to ask the solemn literary question of this occasion. Namely, where would writers be without dedication? Like any other literary theorist, I would not ask that question if I didn't already know the answer. Writers would be left with a blank page, right here, which is where dedications go. Book dedications have been around about as long as books have, so bear in mind that their history, as I'm about to gallop through it here, is the 10-minute pre-shrunk version. I don't know whether any of you would have been unmerry enough on Christmas Day some years ago to be scanning the obituaries in the December 25th New York Times, as I was, but if you had, you'd have noticed the obituary which began, "Mary Moore Cross, to whom the late Ezra Pound in 1906 dedicated his first book of poems, Personae, died Thursday at her home in Montclair, New Jersey." That a few words at the front of a book should become the grace notes of a life of 92 years, as Mary Moore Cross's life was, is admittedly unusual. But dedication pages hold a strange power. The practice of an author singling out someone for inscription there, alone with the white space and posterity, has gone on automatically for centuries. Dedications began as barter, a kind of wordsmith's wampum. Writers as far back as Virgil and Lucretius can be found repaying their moneyed patrons with dedications. By Elizabethan times, patron wooing had become so standard that one practitioner said dedications simply were bills of lading, drawn by the witty upon the great and payable at sight. Honeying up a page or more with flattery became an art form of its own. Dr. Samuel Johnson is known to have ghost-written dedications for the books of at least a dozen of his friends. What saves the book dedication from being just an overweight black-and-white Valentine is what makes interesting the entire business of books, the play of personality. Some of our departed luminaries of fiction, for instance, left dedications in which their singularities shine through with high wattage. William Faulkner was at his most squirely when he tapped in at the start of The Town, "To Phil Stone, he did half the laughing for 30 years." And with what perseverance Ernest Hemingway reported on his domestic situation, "The sun also rises for Hadley. Death in the afternoon to Pauline. For whom the bell tolls for Martha Gellhorn. Across the river and into the trees to Mary." Even book critics, in the poetic words of Robert Burns, "Our friends, the reviewers, those chippers and hewers," even the critics have been honored, sort of, in dedications. In 1893, when Lew Wallace's novel The Prince of India was about to come out, he fretfully dedicated it to his father, who loved literature for the pleasure it brought him, and could I have had his counsel while composing this work, the critics would not be so terrible to me now that it is going to press. Some dedications are honed for mischief. In his translation of The Arabian Nights in the late 19th century, Sir Richard Burton, the writer-explorer, not the memorable Welshman and actor, Sir Richard Burton took revenge on the curators of Oxford's Bodleian Library by dedicating to them the volume with the rarest and raciest passages from the manuscript they had refused to loan him. Doig's Law of Book Dedications, which I check every so often against the bestseller list, is that the loftier the sales of a book, the more mundane its dedication is likely to be. I think I formulated this during a book season when Jacqueline Suzanne dedicated her latest to her mother, and Charles Colson piously dedicated some lesson he'd learned out of a Watergate jail term to his father. Having thumbed through the bestsellers on a recent New York Times list in preparation for tonight, I can report that my theory is still pretty much true, although with an occasional interesting blip. That good writer and good man Tony Hillerman graciously includes in his dedication his brother-in-law. By and large, though, bestsellerdom tends toward the tepid in dedications. The tamest part of something titled Memories of Midnight surely is Sidney Sheldon dedicating it simply for Alexandra with love. And I think it's really a little disappointing that Donald Trump did not dedicate his book to himself. If there is a single steady reward for the dedication watcher, it is the frequency with which the genre produces gems of an expected rightness. Can anyone doubt that Professor Colin Cherry, after dedicating the first edition of On Human Communication to my dog Pim, would eventually dedicate the second edition to all those human beings who inquired so kindly after my dog Pim, and then the fateful third edition to the memory of my dog Pim? Or that it would be an Englishman idiosyncratically writing about wildlife who could come up with my own all-time favorite dedication. Jonathan Franklin, in his book Two Owls at Eton, managed to remember to dedicate it to his mother, who bravely put up with my owls for many a long and troublesome day when I was absent. The future seems secure. As long as there are mates to be assuaged, critics to be fretted about, mothers to put up with Etonian owls, dedication will have its place in literature, right there beyond the title page, just where young Ezra Pound assured a young woman all those years ago that this book is for Mary Moore of Trenton, if she wants it. For my part, in my 6 books so far, I've managed dedications to my wife Carol, to a gang of 18 friends who are writers and teachers in Missoula, Montana, to a friend who saved me from drowning, to my wife again, same wife, to my graduate school history professor who tried to show me the patterns on the land, and now, in Ride With Me, Mariah, Montana, to the writer Wallace Stegner, who simply seems to me, as I put it on that page of waiting space, one in a century. With that dedication of mine, and Anne's to her husband Ed, and Clive's for Eddie and June, and AC's to his doctor, and Edith's to her husband Charlie, we're all saying what the dedication always has said. Thanks from us and our hundreds and hundreds of sentences. Ezra Pound assured a young woman all those years ago that this book is for Mary Moore of Trenton, if she wants it. For my part, in my 6 books so far, I've managed dedications to my wife, Carol, to a gang of 18 friends who are writers and teachers in Missoula, Montana, to a friend who saved me from drowning, to my wife again, same wife, to my graduate school history professor who tried to show me the patterns on the land, and now in Ride With Me, Mariah, Montana, to the writer Wallace Stegner, who simply seems to me, as I put it on that page of waiting space, one in a century. With that dedication of mine, and Anne's to her husband Charlie, and Clive's for Eddie and June, and AC's to his doctor, and Edith's to her husband, we are all saying what the dedication always has said. Thanks from us and our hundreds and hundreds of sentences.